This episode is brought to you by HH Bespoke Spirits, a fashionable portfolio of unique spirits, including bespoke gin, rum, and vodka, inspired by the rich cultural history and distinctive style of the Harlem Renaissance. Learn more at hhbespokespirits.com.
This week on Meet and Three, we bring you stories about how Gen Z is different from their millennial predecessors through the lens of food.
My knowledge of alcohol didn't really come from like Bud Light commercials or like Project X.
Yeah, and that's my gripe with the platform as well, is that all these DIY videos, cooking videos, they're 20 seconds.
What's one food item from your childhood that you wish you could have today?
Dunkaroos, because they don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. Although, the Dunkaroos Twitter was activated again a year ago, so it's only a matter of time. They've tweeted a couple times. It's pretty hype.
Listen to Meat and Three, HRN's food news and storytelling roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're recording remotely, and this is Tuesday, August 11th, 2020. It's a very special show. Our good friend Tom Acatelli has written another book about beer. His first one, The Audacity of Hops, for me captured the origin story of craft beer in America. And now he's come back way back to 1600s or 1800s, talking about the origins and the rise of Pilsner in the world and in America. So Tom, let's just start talking with you. Just introduce yourself and just tell us about how this book project started.
Jimmy, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it. The book is Pilsner, How the Beer of Kings Changed the World. And it's exactly what the title sounds like. I used to write quite a bit about craft beer and the origins of microbrewing or craft beer or whatever it's called now. But I wanted to see what predated it. What laid the groundwork? What set up the need for such a terrific counter reaction that craft beer has been to macro brewing? And I found that in the history of Pilsner, which remains the dominant beer style in the world, and sort of caused the big bang for the beer universe we're living in now. Without the rise of Pilsner beginning in the 1840s and the conditions that led to that rise, we wouldn't have the beer marketplace that we do now. And that's what I wanted to get at, and that's what the book is all about, and how Pilsner intersects with so many different things, not only in brewing and brewing technology and beer, but in the world at large, and how it helped cause the craft beer movement.
Well, Tom, it's a really great book. I'm fairly early in the book, but I'm up to about 1845, so I'm definitely looking forward to reading the whole book, and it's been one of the more enjoyable beer history books I've read in a while. And let's introduce, so Chris Loring, introduce yourself and tell us your connection to Pilsners and lagers.
Chris Loring, founder, head brewer of Notch Brewing in Salem, Massachusetts, soon second location in Boston. Affiliation to Pilsner. I've been a professional brewer since 93, and I always brewed British ales. And then in 2005, I went to the Czech Republic and visited Prague and Pilsen. And that just was an epiphany. And I never looked back. And that started my whole, you know, career of really getting deep into lager and Pilsner in particular. We just had that moment. I think every brewer has that drinking moment where they have something and they say, wow, this is something totally unique and special.
One of the most special brewery taproom visits I did, I visited you about 4 or 5 years ago. We did an episode of Beer Sessions Radio, and it was so great. You had, how many taps do you have dedicated to the Czech style pour?
We have 4 of the Lucre side pull faucets, and we only put Czech lager through it. We won't put anything else through it. And we typically have all 4 filled at all times.
That's great. That was a very special experience. And our other friend from Three's Brewing, you know, in the rise of craft beer, it took a while for there to be a good pils in New York City. And one of the first really good pils I had in New York City was from Three's Brewing, the Vleet. Matt, will you introduce yourself?
Yeah, Matt Levy, head brewer of Three's Brewing, Brooklyn, New York. You know, Pilsner is... it's an ongoing exploration for me. And you know, I've been brewing professionally for 10 years. And my brewing career actually started at Jolly Pumpkin, and I was really into kind of these like subtle but wild things. You know, working at Peekskill Brewery, and actually Vliet was the beer that got me into Pilsner, which is kind of interesting. And I wanted to work at Threes because of that beer. I wanted to make that beer, and then I wanted to dive deep into kind of restrained brewing. And Vliet is actually kind of our like, you know, most robust, hoppiest lagers, and we continuously keep stripping things back, and it's something that I'm really excited about. But we, you know, last fall I visited Bamberg and Czech Republic and had, you know, another one of those incredible moments. And you know, just like Chris is saying, like it's been kind of fascinating getting into them. But I mean, I feel like my interest in them could apply to really any style. It's more of an approach to brewing rather than an affinity for a particular style. Pilsner just happens to taste better, you know, than most.
That's great.
Styles.
So that's a great introduction. Now we'll go back to Tom. So Tom, you know, my first question for an author whose book I like is, tell us about researching the book, because you cut through a lot of myths. You know, there were some myths about monks stealing yeast and bringing it back. You know, so how were you researching the book? And tell us about a few of those myths that you were able to break through.
Well, a lot of the research had to do with going back to some primary sources. And I was very lucky in that regard because Evan Rail, a beer writer, American beer writer who lives in Prague, he translated a lot of the early documents relating to the first producer of Pilsner in Pilsen in present-day Czechia. So I had that at my disposal. There's fantastic troves of research at the larger breweries in the United States, such as, you know, Anheuser-Busch, Miller. And there's a lot of places that preserve, you know, the correspondence and the recipes in some cases, and the back and forth between brewers in the 19th century. I'm thinking of the American Brewery Anna Association. So that was a big help, just to have the information there, and in many cases already collated. So as far as some of the myths, it gets kind of real fun, you know. Like beer throws up a lot of legend. You know, people are very passionate about it, and stuff gets embellished in retellings. One of my favorite myths was that the yeast for the original Pilsner was smuggled over the border from Bavaria into the Austrian Empire, into Pilsen, by a monk who wouldn't be questioned by authorities because he was moving between two heavily Catholic countries. But that's very much a myth. Also, one of the things that struck me early on and sort of got me excited about the project was that the brewing, I mean, we often think of Pilsner as the first, you know, golden or light colored beer that looks like sunshine or something. And while that's the case, it was the first really bright beer. There were plenty of lighter colored beers then, as early as, you know, going back to the turn of the 18th to 19th century. So there's sort of this myth that, you know, Pilsner is the first light colored beer, and everything else was these dark, milky, murky ales you couldn't see through. And that's just not the case. Pale ale had been around for decades. There were amber ales. There was the Vienna Lager, which was developed around the same time. So,
well, that's great, man. You know, in terms of the history as well, like, let's go way back. Like, you know, beer forever was lager. I mean, excuse me, ales, right? And it was what, top fermented? It was hard. It was easy to make. I'm going backwards. It was easy to make. And people were making it for thousands of years. When and where did someone figure out this bottom fermented lager? And then I can have the brewers jump in about the difference in brewing from their perspectives as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, Chris and Matt can probably talk much more about the science behind it and the technique behind it. But basically, yes, for millennia, starting in the mountains of present-day Iran, people have been brewing beer. And it was basically what we now today call ale. And it was largely by accident that it was largely an accident of science that it became ale, because the yeast that works, that can ferment and work through ale, can basically ferment it at warmer temperatures, right? So something, a brew left out overnight or for a while will eventually start fermenting with just the yeast around it. The sort of big jump that occurred with lager is that the yeast is bottom fermenting, right? And it was all poorly misunderstood for a long, long time. And it was the Germans and the Czechs. We don't know exactly who. By the mid-19th century, they were making lagers consistently. And that's one of the reasons, and the Germans especially were doing this, and Bavarians especially among the Germans. And this is the main thing that spurred the innovation over the border in Bohemia with Pilsen. The burghers of Pilsen, the sort of the town elders who had the right to brew beer and to sell beer locally, were nervous. They were nervous about these Bavarian interlopers with their fantastic, crisp, lighter tasting, lighter colored lagers. And they wanted in on the action. And so they built their own brewery. And lo and behold, that's where we got Pilsner.
And it's a great story, and it's in your book. Let's ask Matt or Chris, have either of you really looked into the history of Pilsner? And in particular, like, if we didn't have Louis Pasteur, you didn't know what yeast was, how do you think that, whether it was in the 1600s, that German or Czech brewer somehow figured out the beer would ferment differently in the cold cellar? I mean, does anyone have any thoughts about that? Some weird origin story.
Chris, you want to take this? Or?
Not really.
I know, right? I know you've spent a lot more time in the Czech Republic than I have. And I went around with Dan Suarez and Matt Moon, the assistant brewer at Suarez, last fall, and got a lot of history launched at me that I couldn't believe, just about, you know, the kind of like communities that would have to bring in ice blocks to fill the cellar to keep everything cold throughout the summer, and it would just slowly melt. Just the way that they built those caves just kind of blows my mind. I don't know. I think, you know, nobody today is I feel like we're all too lazy today to be able to kind of wrap our head around that. But I have no idea. Like, yeah, maybe Chris, you probably maybe know more, but yeah.
But Chris, yeah. What about your myths, Chris? Any like when you were at first in the Czech Republic, were there any myths of the origin that you heard?
I mean, origin wise, I don't really. I mean, there's a lot of myths about Pilsner, you know, in terms of style and what they taste like and regionality variances and all that good stuff. And I love all that. As far as like the origins of it, I mean, I always heard, you know, the myths that I don't know are true or not, and Tom can probably help me out. I always heard Pilsner was hand in hand with clear glass. You know, the clear glass was like, you know, really driving why people wanted bright being clear, bright beer. I don't know if that's even true, but it's a story we have. There's so much in beer that has been handed down that is just basically folklore that's not true.
Right.
And so much of it's just fun, but a lot of it's just wrong. So it's hard, right. You know.
The glass bit is absolutely correct, actually. And that's one
that's
of the
good
things
to hear.
That sort of helped Pilsner's rise was that, you know, people were not only drinking out of glasses, which was being mass produced for the first time in history, but were also brewers were also learning to bottle and bottle consistently and bottle efficiently and cork the bottles and get the bottles out the door and pasteurize them and have the beer arrive in much the same state it had left the brewery in. So yeah, that's one of the things that helped Pilsner's rise is that it looked good in the glass. It looked beautiful. It looked modern. It looked downright healthy.
But what I don't understand about that, I mean, you could make bright, clear, light colored ales. Like there's nothing about the lager yeast that would necessarily kind of lead people to need to ferment these things cold and long in these caves.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have anything kind of like specific in the history to, I don't know, ales versus lagers and why, I don't know, why bright beer was for lager? It's just about time.
I think it was about timing in the process, but the ales that back then, the palest ales would have been from Northern England, and they themselves would not, they would look kind of amberish, amber-like or red.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't look as clear and bright as Pilsner did. The only beer style that came close on the continent at the time was Vienna Lager. And Vienna, I mean, Vienna lager is kind of reddish itself, reddish amber. But as far as, you know, the yeast, as far as the development of lager, part of it was also an accident because, you know, it was born of a hybrid yeast strain. I mean, part of which might have been born and raised in South America and come over during the Age of Discovery, all the ships going across the Atlantic. So that's a part of it, too.
There's a lot in there. And I think that we're probably going beyond what your book covered. You know, let's jump up. So, Chris, when you were first, you know, learning about Czech pills and everything, this is some of the styles that inspired you, because there's so many different colors, you know, there's and different gravities.
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, the fascinating thing about Czech beer is that as someone who'd never been, I always thought, you know, Czech Republic was Pilsner, right? And that in Pilsner of itself is even, they don't even call it Pilsner, they call it pale lager, unless it comes from Pilsen. So there was that whole thing. And then to understand that the way the Czechs designate beer style is not just by a name, you know, like Dunkel or Helles, it's by gravity in Plato, you know, 10, 12, 14, and then by color, you know, light, amber, dark. So that kind of blew my mind that there was this, you know, pretty large range of styles and strengths in the Czech Republic that, you know, the U.S. beer consumer or beer geek or brewer had no idea about. And, you know, that was a real kind of fun thing for me to discover. But then the strengths really kind of hit me too, because obviously I brew session beer primarily. And to find out that the Sitka, which is the 10 Plato Czech pale lager, which we would know as Pilsner, I mean, that's basically their light beer. But it's wildly flavorful. And, you know, you can go to the beer hall and have 10, you know, over the course of an afternoon and be pretty good. So, yeah, that was the real kind of like epiphany, you know, for me that it wasn't this one Czech lager or Pilsner wasn't monolithic. The regional variances within Czech Republic and then to, you know, compare Germany, they're quite different. And then even among that, the lagers there were pretty varied. But it's, you know, I'm not sure why it didn't get exposure. It seems like the Czech Republic right now, especially in the craft beer scene in the last 2, 3, 4 years, has really gotten a lot of attention. And it's deserved because a lot of the brewers there are doing really wonderful things. And the processes that they implement are really cool in terms of open fermentation and the way they lager. It's a really great brewing culture. I'm really glad it's getting some exposure. I mean, obviously, I dig it. So,
yeah, it does seem like it's a brewer-driven you know, explosion in the States. And I know that, you know, you come to mind immediately when I think of Czech lagers in the States and like really like talking about decoction and talking about like process as a part of the style, you know, and putting it like kind of front and center on the can, on your menu, I would assume. Unfortunately, I haven't been there, but it's almost like, Chris, do you think it's like a selling point at this point?
It is for, yeah, it's, you know, it's really funny you say that, Matt, because during the whole, you know, quarantine and going to all curbside, not having taproom sales, we put a lot of beer into cans. We never would put into cans. Mm-hmm. And when we did that, we started describing the process in terms of decoctions and how it was fermented and, you know, was it spunded? Was it, how long did it lager for? And all these kind of beer geeky things that we love as brewers that like, does the consumer care? We was like, let's try it. And we started putting all the information on the labels and people started asking questions about what it meant. And they got more involved with the process and it was fun. You know, and so I think that is a selling feature to, you know, a more enthusiastic consumer, which is great. We love, as brewers, we love enthusiastic consumers like that, that really want to get into the detail. Yeah. And for, you know, I think for the average consumer, I don't know if there's an average consumer, but for the most consumers, it tastes good. They know the style and the alcohol content. And that's about it. But I love people like who want the deep dive on it. It's a lot of fun.
That's great. And Matt, I'm drinking right now a Schilling from New Hampshire, their Alexander 10 Czech style Pilsner. So do you know those guys?
Honestly, I'm about to meet them, hang out with them for the first time. We've been emailing. They contacted me a couple months ago and was like, we'd love to make a beer with you whenever you want. I know things are crazy right now. And so we've been going back and forth for a couple months. We're selling their beer pretty actively through our like web store shop and at our bar here. Which just opened, our backyard just opened last weekend. So things are amping up, you know, hopefully for the long term. But great brewers. I mean, I'm really excited to go up there and taste their beer, hopefully from the taps if they have anything on draft. I've had the Alexander. We have Czech Dark downstairs, for sale. But really, really good guys. Super, super nerdy about lager.
That's great. I found them at the West Side Market on 3rd Ave. Shout out to Martin Johnson, who's a great beer writer. He does the purchasing there. And it's just made my day big time. So, Tom, back to you. So with the book, you guys got to read it, Pilsner. There's a lot of history that we're not going to talk about on the show. But a couple points you wanted to bring up, talk about. One of them, it's the role of immigration in the spread of Pilsner in America. So originally, what were people drinking in America? We know they were drinking whiskey. We know they had hard cider. But they were also, Americans were also drinking porters and ales in the early 1800s.
That's exactly right. And first of all, I just want to say as a consumer, it's fantastic to see the lighter lagers and Pilsner-inspired and Pilsner beers out there. It's just a fantastic array, and I really applaud the brewers doing it because, as I understand it from my layman's perspective, it's not easy to get a very good Pilsner. But yes, America was very much ale country when it came to beer. And what happened beginning in the 1840s and through the rest of the century was an influx of Czechs and Germans came and settled mostly in the upper Midwest and sort of transformed in a generation or two not only the brewing industry in the U.S., but also the beer culture. Americans were noted the world over by then for, drinking to get drunk. Whiskey was the best-selling alcoholic beverage. Hard cider that was extremely strong was very popular in the Northeast. So Americans weren't known for the sort of nuance when it came to drinking or the leisure. But the Germans especially brought with them the concept of beer gardens and sort of drinking for, if not taste, if more than at least for relaxation. And it was also important, too, that these beer gardens and beer halls were family friendly. And that really struck, Native Americans who had been here when they arrived. That helped really to change the culture in all sorts of ways. And I want to get back, Jimmy, just to the point earlier, we were talking about the origin of lighter colored beers in the 19th century. Another innovation I forgot to mention, but it's in the book, was the sort of evolution of roasting, how to roast malts. And English breweries and malters were roasting some of the lightest malts ever by the early 1800s. And that contributed mightily to the idea and to the development of, lighter colored beers.
And what was the specific technological innovation that led to pale malts?
Well, there was an English engineer by the name of, his name was Daniel Wheeler. And in 1818, he patented an invention for more uniformly roasting malts that were used in brewing. Before, brewers generally spread the malt on a kind of perforated floor and just lit a fire underneath from wood, coal, or coke. And, the result was an unevenness in the roasting, okay? And some roasted more deeply than others, some roasted faster. But it left behind a general darkness and smokiness, okay? And if you go back and look at some of the writing about beer back then, they're often described as sort of burnt. The ales are described as burnt or even scorched tasting. Wheeler's invention replaced that floor kennel concept and helped people do, more uniform roasting and to greater specification. And he's forgotten. And there's a lot of characters, and I hope the book brings them back to life a bit, that are forgotten in this evolution and contributed to the beer we drink even today. It's not an accident that the beer market ended up as it has.
No, it's very interesting. And also, in the 19th century, I mean, you also mentioned, Burton-on-Trent, the English, the IPAs. I know that even into the 1890s, they were being exported into the United States. And so there was I think at then there was still the diversity, right? There were pale ales and IPAs, and there was the rise of pils.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes, and what began to happen, especially after Prohibition ended in 1933, was that Pilsner kind of swept everything before it. And beers inspired by Pilsner and beers chasing the market share that Pilsner producers had swept everything. One of the great examples, I think, is what happened to cream ale, which, you know, really had a heyday for a long time and had a resurgence in the 1960s and 1970s. I can remember my uncles drinking Genesee cream ale in upstate New York, in those green cans and bottles. But even, you know, Pilsner just sort of swept those guys aside. And especially with the rise of light beer in the 1970s, it really pushed everything aside. And you know, and styles such as IPA and styles such as porter and styles that we take for granted now, you know, seem doomed, as did most breweries in the country, you know. And then you have this remarkable counter-reaction to that environment, you know, manifested by people like Matt and Chris and what they produce. It's just,
well, then,
really,
Tom, then we have to start reading your first book, The Audacity of Hops, which is yes. The story of the craft beer revolution. But let's go to Matt. So, Matt, you said that you wanted to work at Threes because you were inspired by the Vliet pils. So tell us the evolution of the pils and lagers at Threes since you've been there.
Well, you know, I guess the big thing is that we've started to ferment and age in oak, which started a few years back, and it was kind of a happy accident. It was just an experiment that we were trying. And we were trying to make a subtle beer, and really I love, honestly, just like handing somebody a glass and not telling them what's in it. Preferably I wouldn't even talk about the fooder when it comes to this beer, because I think it's kicking and screaming our fooder pills. I think it's just like a really nice pilsner, and it just has something different. It's not meant to be super oaky. But we, you know, we have, I think that, you know, in the craft beer industry, there's, you know, this kind of fervent for the cult of the new thing, you know, beers with marshmallows and vanilla and a bunch of different shit in them. And I really enjoy, like, kind of exploring kind of the space between these lager styles. And it's true what Chris said, like, the Czech Republic is kind of the perfect example of that. You can go to a bar and just have so much variety. And sometimes it's just a technique that separates one Play-Doh from the next. Maybe a little bit more grain, maybe longer boil. But really it's just like very, very process driven and really thoughtful. And I think like coaxing out kind of the subtlety and the space between different ingredients is great. So we have a rice lager coming out in 2 weeks. You know, today we canned Vliet. Last week we canned some Helles. But pretty much weekly we have a different lager coming out. And I think it's important to show that lagers are not just one thing. They can, you know, there's a lot of interesting kind of variants depending on how you know, yeast, process, you know, obviously all the other ingredients. But that exploration is like what gets me and the other brewers at Three, is because it is always all of us kind of coming together and deciding these things, gets us really excited. So we have, you know, a lot of lagers, you know.
Matt, you know, you've worked or working with some really great Pilsner brewers. Like you mentioned Dan Suarez at Suarez Family. You're going up to Schilling in New Hampshire. What do you learn from these other brewers? And are there any beers that you're making that anything rubs off from these guys?
Mostly, you know, when I hang out with Dan, and it was really, you know, he's a good friend, and beyond our trip, you know, we hang out a bunch, and Matt, the assistant brewer there, it's just learning how to taste. So it's not necessarily like a process thing. It's learning kind of, you know, about the simplicity of the ingredients. So, at this point in my journey as a brewer, I'm, you know, thinking a lot about like seasoning, like salting hops, you know, pH, but really just like kind of that touch note, that way that the crispness, like the really subtle points. And I'm not always happy with our beers. I don't think any brewer is, but it's like, you know, when we nerd out over lagers, it's usually talking about those things. We're not talking about, you know, the dry hop. Usually there isn't one, but we're like really it's much like the hop load. It's really just the kind of the finer points and then just kind of talking about the flavor. So in our beers, you know, I think Vliet is changed. It's constantly changing. And that's just our evolution here. We're changing the recipe constantly and just like tweaking things. And that comes from hanging out with people and learning and, you know, tasting their beers. So usually it's not like a specific process thing that Dan or, you know, really are out West, like, you know, Freem or Heater Allen or, you know, all these great, great lager breweries been doing it a long time. It's more just like they're good tasters, you know?
That's great, man. It's really great talking to you again. I've really seen you rise up and I'm very proud of you. You're really becoming a leader in the brewing community. Tom, so when we were putting the show together, I mentioned Chris Loring at Notch and you kind of perked up. So as a beer lover, you tell us about Notch Brewing and the beers.
Oh, well, first of all, did somebody mention Rice Lager?
Yep.
Matt did, yeah.
Matt, okay. No, I've just never heard of that. What is that exactly?
Oh, Rice Lager's it's a lager with rice.
Okay. No, just
the description. It has rice in the mash, and for our beer, Gowanus Gold, that's what it's called. We use some Carolina Gold rice and spend a day cooking it on the side before brewing with it, and it adds a really nice crisp dry flavor. Really, it actually gets kind of surprisingly floral with this rice and it's, you know, rice flavor. But you know, any Japanese restaurant, go get some rice lager while you have your sushi.
Yeah, Tom, was that a serious question?
No, it was. I'd never heard of it before, but I knew that some of the bigger brewers, you know, introduced things like rice and corn, and way back to make up for the barley they couldn't get in North America versus Europe, and they caught a lot of flack for it for a long time. And I know that some craft breweries have come around to embracing those ingredients, which, if you think about it, were kind of traditional.
Typically we're just looking for things that'll produce good flavor that complements the lagers. And like, you know, we have Echo of Nothing, our Mexican lager that has corn, and we're always looking for just typically local. The Carolina Gold stuff is we can't get local rice from New York. If you know of any place, let me know. But just things that are like flavor forward and interesting to do it, to take kind of tradition and make it our own.
Right. Well, I'm actually in North Carolina right now where I grew up, and I'm drinking a licensed to haze double IPA from Green Man Brewing in Asheville. And it's kind of the antithesis of what Chris's brewery does. And I know about Notch because I live in Cambridge. I'm visiting North Carolina now, but I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I remember when Notch sort of hit the shelves. And it was such to me, a novel thing back then because it was session beers and it was a brewery dedicated just to session beers at a time when IPA was reaching a kind of end of history moment where it was just getting stronger and stronger and busier. And here came a brewery that was like, no, we're going to do lower alcohol sessionable brews and not, you know, wallop you with a lot of bitterness at the first sip. And I was a big fan right away of the Pilsner long before I had the idea for the book.
That's great. Hey, so that's a great, we're going to take a short break here. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by HH Bespoke Spirits, a fashionable portfolio of unique spirits, including bespoke gin, rum, and vodka. The family behind the award-winning boutique and clothing brand Harlem Haberdashery has expanded to distill spirits inspired by the rich cultural history and distinctive style of the Harlem Renaissance. The Black and family-owned HH Bespoke Spirits are available at bars, restaurants, and retailers across the United States. Learn more at hhbespokespirits.com and follow them at hhbespokespirit.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're talking the new book, Pilsner, with Tom Acatelli, the author, and Chris Loring of Notch Brewing, and Matt Levy of Threes Brewing in Brooklyn. And just check it out, heritageradionetwork.org. Become a member and donate. heritageradionetwork.org. So, Tom, you were just talking about when you first discovered Notch Brewing in Salem. And Chris, my big question is, how do you have different beers. You have session ales, and you have your Czech lagers. What part of the brewery is dedicated to the Czech lagers? Is there anything different about that process? Just tell us a little bit about how you're running a brewery that has that specialty as well as your regular beers.
I guess there's some subtle differences in how we do it, and it starts in the brew house. But we'll do, so we typically do mostly Czech lagers. We do some German lagers. We do some continental styles like Kolsch and all. And then we do a number of hazy New England style, session or non-session IPAs so that we have the ability to do what we want. They pay the bills. I always joke that the IPA brew day is pretty friggin' easy. It's a single temperature infusion, and you're pretty much done in 5.5 hours minus CIP. And the lager brewing really is when things get ramped up when we get the minutia. And so we have a decoction capable brew house where we can do multiple decoctions. We can do single, double, triple. We can also do cereal mashing if we want to do a rice lager or we want to do a cream ale. From there, we do all of our Czech lagers and most of our kind of Bomberg, Franconian styles are open fermented. And then none of our ales are really open fermented. We don't really do British beer, so it doesn't really, fit into that. Most of our ales just go into a unitank, closed right away. And the rest of the process kind of is pretty straightforward. But with the lagers, we go to open fermentation. It's kind of like they use a tank in Germany where they want the trube or the cold break not to be consumed with or mingled with fermentation. It's called a flotation tank, but when you do open fermentation, it kind of acts as a flotation tank in a way because that's all caught within the Kreuzen. And it's kind of interesting, Tom, hearing about top fermenting versus bottom fermenting, because my first 10 years I did all open fermentation with British ale yeast, and when I do lager fermentation, it behaves almost the exact same way. The Kreuzen looks exactly the same. And so I think there's a myth about top and bottom fermentation. I think it's cold and warm fermentation. I'm kind of convinced of it. I'm really convinced of it. And I don't have any scientific proof or, other than just, empirical observation. So anyways, we do open fermentation. We spun, so we take it out of the open fermenter about half gravity. We put it into a closed. We spun so that we bung the tank and capture natural carbonation. We bring it into horizontal lagering tanks for maturation. And so, none of the ales really go through those processes. It's just a different, basically, thread, if you will. It's just thinking about it differently in the way we do it. And then the way we package the beer as well sometimes is different as well. We do Stichfass, which are the German gravity casks for a lot of our beer. So there's no extraneous CO2 pushing the beer out through a tap. It's just basically coming out through gravity. Yeah, so it just, you put your lager brewer kind of boots on and go at it, and it's just different than ale brewing.
And Chris, that brings up something. So, due to COVID, and you're probably selling a lot, I don't know how your tap sales are, but for me, the big thrill of going to your tap room was tasting your beer out of your Czech, your Czech pours. How are your beers different in a can versus out of the taps?
I mean, the beers themselves are the same. It's basically, we've split off of a lagering tank to draft or can. So it's the same beer, same carbonation levels. There's some variance there. If we do a half, we do a higher carbonation. But for the draft. But the experience is different, right? You go to the beer hall, or you come to Notch, and you get that in a half-liter Czech mug with four fingers of dense wet foam that you need to drink through. And that can't be recreated out of the can. It just can't. You can't get that same density of foam without that lucre tap. You do lose that a little bit, but the flavor of the beer is the same. But that experience of drinking through that foam is something that's pretty unique to the Czech Republic and pretty wonderful. Much different than the slow pour pils, which is a whole other kind of, German thing. And I'm sure that, I don't know if you can recreate that out of the can as well, but there's, yeah, so you do lose a little bit of that experience. Even here, you know, today we're pouring out of plastic so that we don't have to have, transmission issues in terms of returning glassware, employees touching and whatnot. So we do plastic right now one way. And I hate that. I mean, I hate the experience of that. And we're trying to pour the Czech taps in the plastic cups and it's just a shit show. You know, it really is. It's not what we want to do, but we're doing the best we can based on the circumstances.
Yeah, man. And that brings us now back to the book with Tom. So the book opens, you're talking about this, the bombing in 1945 of the Burger Brewery in Pilsen. But let's just tell us that story and why that was such a focal point of your book. The quote you have, it was from the burgers of the guys that ran the town of Pilsen, right, in Czechoslovakia in like 1830s. It says,
yes.
We must have good and cheap beer.
Exactly. They had the right to brew and sell beer locally. And basically they were upset over the market share that these lager brewers in Bavaria over the internet, which was then, it still is, but was an international border. They were coming in and taking their market share basically. So Pilsner was spawned largely just through market competition. The brewers in Pilsen, the burgers who had the brewing rights, did not like this competition, so they were going to co-opt it. They were going to hire Bavarian talent. They were going to use Bavarian techniques, and they were going to use Bavarian approaches and try to make their own lager to appeal to the locals and keep that market share.
That's great. So, I mean, Matt, as a brewer, how do you imagine this big? I still want to go back to the history because there's a lot more to this book. But can you imagine if you only had like some type of ales that were made with locally roasted malts, and suddenly somebody was selling a decent lager that had a little more technology behind it, and this is like 1830s. I don't know if you can imagine this.
Yeah, I'm sitting in an office that's like 100 degrees right now. And it would probably be pretty freaking good. Probably one of my favorite beers of all time is from Spetzal in Bamberg, and that's a smoked beer. So I don't know, I'm kind of torn on it, but I love the, yeah, I hear you, Jimmy.
Cause I have this romantic image of the pre-technology beers, because it seems like Pilsner and your book, Tom, it talks about things like, the invention of measuring instruments like saccometers and even thermometers to measure. I know that was all late 1700s. And then, of course, refrigeration and steam power for transport and export. But I remember it was like a number of years ago in the New York Times Magazine, it said there was this like photo essay on what breakfast was, and like in the 20th century everything was packaged, it was like packaged and processed food, and then like back to the 19th century the first innovation was packaging, which implied there was transportation, but like it was like the 1820 breakfast was like the leftover piece of meat and a leftover piece of pie. And I remember thinking, man, that's what I like. And one time I asked Garrett Oliver, I said, how does that relate to beer? And ultimately, he just talked about the change in technology. So, and we've tried over the years, there's always someone that's making historical beer or something. But I just wonder if that resonates with anybody before we move on to the next subject.
Yeah,
I
would just going to say quickly, like, for sure, it's been pretty depressing during COVID, not to have our tap room open and have people here at the source, putting everything in cans, sending it out to grocery stores. It's all kind of within the state, but it's, mostly a tri-state area, but it's still that localized experience that you get, biking around Franconia and going from town to town. Each town had a brewery, and you just go and have the thing straight from the tap. It's usually one type. And it's really fresh and usually pretty good, but it's hard for me to recreate that or I can't recreate that without the tap room, but that's the closest thing. And I love the fact that we have multiple tap rooms, that we can have that connection to people and pour it right and serve it right. These are tough times, but we're all kind of getting by, you know, the least of it, I guess.
No, for sure. And then Matt, you had said earlier that, you were inspired by the Vliet Pilsner at Threes, but now you have a Helles out. So tell us about what brewing that was like and how you guys as a brewery decided to make that version of a lager.
Yeah, that was something I personally just really wanted to do. And I kind of sat the brewers down and I told them, you know, this year we're going to make Helles and it's going to be taproom only. We're not going to send it out at all. It'll be draft only. And, you know, we're going to dedicate this tank to Helles. It'll go from here to the bright tank. And we're going to make it once a month and rotate in with our lager yeast, which is always part of the equation, just ingredient management. And I told them, I was like, if we have a great Helles in 6 months, then that's a win. You know, this is like, let's play the long game with this and like really enjoy the process of tweaking and changing. And it's been really fun. So I think it was one of those kind of challenges of making something subtle that had that, like, you know, that really light kiss of honey and all that malt flavor without too much hop character, which is then honestly branched off to other beers. We've really stripped back most of our lagers because of how much we like that beer. It's one of our favorite beers we make right now, for sure.
I mean, Matt, you guys have a very tight brewery. How do you guys balance, you know, producing ales, IPAs and things, as well as lagers?
Yeah, we also have like a lot of barrels and we're bottling once a week right now with all the mixed culture stuff. Honestly, we have a lot of tanks. We have like 14 fermenters, so it helps let things sit. I really wish we had a different setup. And I'm grateful for what we have, but I do wish that we had the horizontals and we had just, you know, the open fermenter would be incredible for those types of beers, for Czech beers, which I'd like to make more of. We actually just started doing that a couple months ago. And, we're limited by our equipment and I don't want to force it because we don't have the ability to decoct and we don't have the ability to, you know, do some of all the things. I've, you know, one of our brewers, Joel, has visited Notch and it's just like, he like kind of marvels at like the equipment there of what you have, Chris. And we really have to coax it out with like, we have really good water here. It's super soft and we can just kind of like from there, we can start soft and kind of add touches here and there. But we have a lot of fermenters. We let things sit for 6 to 8 weeks. We lose a lot of money. You know, it's not easy doing. It doesn't make a lot of sense making as much lager as we make in New York City. Part of the reason why we partnered with Industrial Arts to make some lager up there, it was necessary. It was like we either start doing a ton of IPA as a business, or we figure out how to do this, and we kind of like I go up there once a week, and it's. So you do the best you can, but lagers are expensive to make. They you know, they take, you know, for us six weeks or so, typically 6 to 8 weeks. And it's a labor of love for sure. I mean, I wouldn't do this job if we were just making beers we didn't like.
Yeah, no, that's, thank you, Matt. And Tom, so back to the book, you know, as Pilsner grew in America, you said that it led to the growth of advertising.
Yes. But that gets to your point, Jimmy, that you made earlier. I think one of the reasons we're where we are in the beer world is because Pilsner was so popular and became so popular and so imitated. I mean, in the book, I call it kind of the yesterday of beers because it's so heavily covered. But I think that's what spawned the craft beer movement and got people to sort of pine for and want what the rise of Pilsner had done away with. You know, and so one of the points I make is that by about the 1950s, and certainly by the early 1970s with the rise of light beer, most of the macro producers had settled on their recipes and their approaches to brewing. And any big changes to the beer were happening after it left the brewery. And that came in marketing and advertising, right? And so Pilsner has a profound effect on the modern advertising industry. You know, the Peel's Brewery, the old Peel's Brewery out of Brooklyn, New York, which went out of business, I believe, in the mid-60s, created the first soft sell campaign with the Bert and Harry cartoons. I don't know if any listeners are familiar with it, but these were extremely popular. It was an extremely popular advertising campaign and commercial, but it sold basically the characters and not necessarily Peel's beer. There were characters who liked Peel's, but the emphasis was on them rather than the product. And it was to the point where people were writing fan letters to these characters. So I just think that aspect sort of rammed this one style into the marketplace to the point where there was this massive reaction to it. And that's, you know, where we are now. That's craft beer.
Well, I'm looking forward to finishing the book. And I recommend it to everyone. Did it just go on sale recently, Tom?
Yeah, it came out last week, early August.
And you have a lot of appearances lined up?
Yes, I'm in the midst of it, but I'm really enjoying this because I am fans of the two brewers you have on right now. So, and of you, Jimmy, of course.
Well, thanks. So how about Chris? Did you get to look at the book at all?
No, I tried to order it when I knew I was coming on, and it was in pre-order, so I haven't had a chance to. I'm really looking forward to reading it, but no, I haven't seen it yet.
And you know, the thing that's cool about this, Tom, is that, you know, when you wrote The Audacity of Hop, which I think every listener should still read, especially the early days of craft beer in America, you really hit it on the nail.
Thank you.
And that was and still might be my favorite book about craft beer. Steve Hindy wrote a great one as well, A Craft Beer Revolution. But again, that was about his era. So you guys kind of covered different eras really well. So, like, I don't want to talk about, you know, Prohibition and the rise of macro because I don't like to talk about that. So I'm going to ask you one more thing back to these innovations and turmoil. I think the 1840s seems to be a very cool time in your book and in this origins of, you know, Czech lagers and pills and everything. So how were they were making different types of lagers, they learned newer technology from the British by the early 1800s. They were making the best beer in the world. They had technology. They'd had their history of Reinhold's Gebot, so they were using best ingredients. How would you compare then or now, you know, the Bavarian beers to the Czech beers? Because they are different, you know, they seem to be distinctly different.
You mean back then?
Back then or now?
Well, back then, the Bavarian beers were darker in color and maybe a little bit maltier, but they were more consistent in their lightness and in their light taste than pretty much any beer out there. What happened in Pilsen, you know, in 1842 is kind of, I don't want to overstate it, but it was almost kind of a miracle of everything coming together. Even if you had changed something like the water, it would have been a different product and had a different effect. So they took what happened in Pilsen just sort of took what the Bavarians were doing one step further. But there was this evolution, you know, you've noted the English techniques that found their ways to Bavaria and Austria. You know, there was an evolution, and Pilsen was the next step in that evolution.
Well, that's great, man. Anybody else want to say anything else before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I have one thing for Chris.
I have one thing for Matt, so here we go.
This is what I want. This is what it's all about, kids. Just stick around.
So for you, oh man, now I'm really curious about what you're going to say. But you said how much do you think your history of British brewing helps with Czech brewing and connects? And I was, you know, probably my favorite beer experience ever was in the caves at Pilsner Urquell, out of the barrel there, out of the pitch barrel. And I was just kind of blown away at how much it reminded me of like English bitter. And it seems to me like, you know, as humans, we make up these styles and we can talk about Pilsner and, you know, it's important to have parameters, but they do kind of come in and out and they're a little bit, don't know, constantly changing and moving. Curious about how much like British brewing connects to you for Czech brewing and like that focus on malt and bitterness and hopping.
Matt, that's really that's great. Let's start with the service first and back into the maybe the brewing, but you know, the parallels between British cask beer, you know, which you know gravity or off the hand pump or beer engine, and then Bavarian or Czech, you know, basically gravity dispense where there's no extraneous CO2 pushing that beer out. It may not be cask conditioned, but it is it's being dispensed by gravity. Those beers are different, man. They just behave differently. They're affected by a slight warming temperature by a couple degrees for the lagers, more so for the ales. It's softer. You get the nuance of it more. And, you know, I don't want to poo-poo a draft beer, but draft beer with extraneous CO2 at the coldest temperatures to make sure you serve it without CO2 breaking out of solution. I mean, there's limitations with that. So, yeah, there's definitely parallels between those two things. And I think then if you think back to what I just talked about with open fermentation, I think the reason I don't get freaked out by open fermentation is because I did it with British brewing for 10 years. And it's like, yeah, we do open fermentation. And seeing the yeast work, you know, you walk in the next day and there's a brewer, you're like, you get the visual. You get, instead of looking at a bucket and seeing if this CO2, you know, you're bubbling out of it, you open the lid and like, hey, we have yeast activity. You know, that's, you're getting really involved with that. And that's always to me really fun. And then bitter versus Pilsner, there's a lot of parallels there. You know, the malt components are different in terms of the color and sweetness, but it's more about the relationship of bitterness and malt and dryness versus, you know, aromatics and, you know, sweetness, aromatics and, you know, sweet flavors or aromas. So yeah, I think there's a lot of parallels there. As much of those seem like distinct styles, you know? So yeah, I think there's, mm-hmm. there's a lot there. So I have a question for you.
Okay.
So often when one says they like a certain direction or they're doing something, that is viewed as being having an attitude or opinion about something that it's not. And I've been criticized by talking about, I'm doing this pitch line barrel project where we put pitch into a barrel like they do at Pilsner Kell and age the beer in pitch because I want that pitch to have influence over the final product. Mm-hmm. And when I talked about this, I said how beer never touched wood in the Czech Republic or in Bavaria. There were some prominent brewers in the world who thought I was calling them out for putting beer into raw wood or into toasted wood or fooder, right? And I wasn't doing that. I was just talking about what I was doing and what I was trying to achieve. So I've had some fooder beers that are wonderful. I mean, they're really great. There's local brewers that are doing that I've had them and like, these are really cool. There's something here, right? So what are you, and my question has been with this, like what's the goal? What are you guys trying to achieve by putting that beer into a fooder or into contact with wood? Like what, is there a goal or are you just trying to see what the result is?
So the story goes like this. We had a new fooder and we had already filled one with a Saison, which is now Wandering Vine. And we felt like the fooder was too intense. So our hope was if we fill it with a lager, then we can strip out some wood that's honestly excessive for our palates, and you know we'll ferment it cold, we'll pull it quickly, maybe a month, and then we'll put a saison in there. And we sat in the backyard after that first batch came out, and I had all the ingredients lined up for a spelt saison, and I had all this lactobacillus and Brettenhaus, and we sat together and we drank it, and we were like, "Fuck no, we're not infecting this thing. We're going to keep it clean as long as possible." It is purely flavor, flavor focused. We hop it less. So I don't know, kind of treat it as a hop, as like another kind of essence. It adds some creaminess. It really softens hop character. So typically Pilsners are pretty crisp and kind of sharp. And all of our fooder lagers are just so much creamier. And it adds depth. And honestly, I hate to say it, but I generally don't really like them. I have them from a lot of breweries and I find that they're just like woody and weird. I have had a few that I like, but I'm not like, you know, I try not to think too much about styles. I really try to just drink a beer and do I enjoy this? Do the flavors come together? Does it work? And you know, I really like it. I really like how we do it. And it's unfortunate that it changes. Like the fooder, and that's also kind of fun, but like the first batch is very different from the third batch. I still remember our third batch through that fooder was my favorite. And we actually just got a new one in and sent the old one back to Fooder Crafters. Because over time it you know, kind of gets depleted. So it's not a great like long-term business plan. It's actually a terrible idea if you want to like make a brand. But you know, we did two beers through it. It was Short Fuse, which is our Fooder Fermented Smoked Helles. It was, you know, a 9.5 Play-Doh beer with some smoke, really light in color, that was in there for 3 weeks. And then we have Kicking and Screaming that's in there for 4 to 6 weeks, depending on the flavor. And it's really, it's just some subtle wood character. Like, I really would prefer not to tell people. A lot of people on our Untappd like are like, it doesn't taste woody enough, or it's not, I don't taste the fooder. And I'm like, okay, that's actually kind of fine. You know, it doesn't, do you like the beer? Like, that's all that matters. So the biggest thing is that it softens hop character and adds flavor, which we get as like kind of toasted marshmallow. I really, really like it. It's like one of those beers that I could have like a 4-pack out in the yard easily.
I'd love to try it.
Yeah. I'd love to try it.
So I've been fortunate because, you know, being in a taproom brewery environment, you experience this as well. Beer shows up and you get to drink a lot of beer from, you know, friends or just, you know, from brewers. And a lot of your beer shows up at our brewery. I just walk in on like a Monday. It's like, there's beer from you guys. Someone gifted it to us. So I've had a fair number of your beers and I've really enjoyed them.
Oh, thank you. I wish I had more of yours. I have had some. We were crushing a Kolsch and an Amber recently. That's actually, I messaged you and was like, can you send me some beer? Guys need it. These are tough times, man. We need your lagers. No, just going to say that the fooder thing is just, I don't know if we're going to keep doing it. It really is just something that we're enjoying doing right now. And I think it's rare for me. There are some times I have a beer and I'm like, oh, there's like an aha moment. And you're like, wow, this is kind of different. And there's something to this. It's weird, but good. And this one did it for all of us, honestly. It's kind of unanimous. So,
yeah. Well, I'll say, Matt, when you drive up to Schilling in Littlefield, New Hampshire this weekend, on your way back, you should just swing into Salem, Massachusetts and see Chris. But also, last thing about your Kicking and Screaming, the fooder. Years ago, I first had it on draft at my old pub, Jimmy's Number 43, and I never thought of oak or wood. I just saw fooder pills, so I actually thought it was just going to be a little funky. I never expected a lot of wood. So to me, it always came off right. Like I wouldn't drink it every day, but I never expected it to be woody. So we have a lot, we could keep going for a long time, but I really appreciate everyone coming on. And Tom Acatelli, thank you so much, for writing another really great book about beer. I said, I'm up to 1845, so I'm going to keep going and I highly recommend it.
Thank you.
Chris Loring at Notch Brewing and Matt Levy at Threes. This has been a really great focused conversation. And just, I want to say thanks again to everybody. And big shout out to our producer, Dylan Hoyer, head engineer, Matt Patterson. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for joining us on Heritage Radio Network. Have a great one. See you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.